U.S. immigration and U.S. innovation. We have some new numbers. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. A new paper published by the nonprofit National Bureau of Economic Research finds that the more innovative technology firms in the U.S. are immigrant-owned. These are companies in fields like engineering and computer system design. This is part of a growing collection of research focusing on the direct impact of immigrant business and the impact that immigrant business owners have on the U.S. economy. Marketplace's Renata Sago has been looking into this. Renata, what are some details of this report?
Researchers took a survey of 7,000 high-tech firms in the U.S. They found that those companies owned by entrepreneurs who were not U.S. citizens at birth, they were more innovative than companies owned by native-born Americans. The majority of immigrant-owned high-tech firms were startups that sold new good or a service no other business had offered before. They applied a new way of buying or even maintaining or accounting for inventory, too. And they also focused on using technology to increase production and reduce costs. Researchers saw this among immigrant owners across education levels, but generally speaking, these business owners did have a higher level of education than U.S.-born entrepreneurs. And most of them, these firms were Latino and Asian-owned.
But there were exceptions in that report?
Right. Immigrant business owners, according to this survey, were not as innovative when it came to copyrighting intellectual property. But the survey suggests these firms become stronger in this category as they grow older. One thing to note here, though, is that the survey finds that the top reason why immigrants even started their firms is because they said they had an innovative idea or product to begin with.
All right. Marketplace's Renata Sago. The National Bureau of Economic Research is perhaps best known in the wider culture for determining when U.S. economic recessions begin and end. Let's check the markets. The 100-share index in London is down 0.7%. Dow and S&P futures are down 0.4%. The benchmark U.S. interest rate down a bit, 2.66% on the 10-year yield. A startup electric vehicle manufacturer called Rivian is getting a lot of attention, most recently with Amazon announcing a $700 million investment. The company is being billed as a potential competitor to Tesla. Rivian has plans to build not sports cars, but electric pickups and SUVs, vehicle styles that do especially well, you've noticed, in the United States. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jack Stewart reports.
Rivian has just two concept vehicles so far, a deep metallic green SUV and a chunky silver pickup. At the unveil in November, company founder RJ Scaringe said the design is supposed to suggest the future, with stripes of red and white lights wrapping the front and back.
It needed to make sure it was making a statement that it was a different kind of vehicle underneath, but still very confident and strong.
Rivian says its vehicles would be great for family camping trips, and an electric work truck could act as a giant battery for electric tools, for example. Stephanie Brindley is principal analyst at IHS Market.
It looks like what we're seeing is investment community and industry reflecting confidence in the plans that Rivian has shared so far.
Rivian also wants to sell its platform of batteries and motors to other manufacturers looking to jumpstart their own electric vehicle programs as a way to make extra money, something that's rare for car startups. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Now to tariffs in theory versus tariffs in the real world here. You see, U.S. importers can apply for exemptions to tariffs on imported steel or aluminum, where they try to make the case that certain kinds of metal are not available from alternate sources. The Commerce Department decides yay or nay on the exemptions. If you get an exemption, the Trump tariffs don't apply. Well, Christine McDaniel, who's a senior research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, has been studying this and found lots of exemptions for Chinese metal imports to the U.S., but comparatively few, in percentage terms, for Canadian metal imports. Compared with the year before tariffs, 40% of Chinese metal can still come in without the new tariff versus just 2% tariffs-free for Canadian metal. Dr. McDaniel, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
So you looked at the data and you find out that there's still a lot of Chinese metal being imported tariff-free to the United States. That's one of the things that you found.
Yeah. So Canada, our largest trading partner, and so many products, including these metals, and such a small share approved to come in compared to China, which was cited very often in justifying these tariffs in the first place.
But when you step back from your data, you know, all these exemptions to tariffs for Chinese metal exports and the Canadians getting hardly any exemptions, you ask yourself, all right, what was the point of these tariffs in the first place, right?
Exactly. And U.S. Steel, for better or worse, you know, they have been asking for protection from imports for decades and decades, and they continue to do so. And when they get protection, prices definitely go up. Jobs might jump up a bit, but then they go down again. You know, steel is just not the job creator it used to be. The real challenge here is, how are we going to keep the United States economy from becoming an island of high-priced metals? Because the bigger the difference between metal prices in the U.S. and the rest of the world, the less reason manufacturers have to locate here.
You served another Republican president, George W. Bush. He did steel tariffs. I think they, you know, they range between 8% and 30% back then. And you studied that episode. What happened? Did we accrue American jobs because of those tariffs?
Well, in the very immediate term, yes, some steel jobs were created. But then in the longer term, what we saw was that more jobs in steel-consuming sectors were lost. In fact, more jobs in steel-consuming manufacturing sectors were lost than even existed in the entire steel industry in the first place.
Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason. Thank you very much for this.
You're welcome.
And Honda is closing car factories for the first time in its history. One is in Britain, Swinton, outside of London. 3,500 British jobs could go. While analysts see Britain's lack of a plan ahead of its impending departure from the European Union as a factor here, the company says it is not Brexit-related. Honda is also closing a factory in Turkey. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report, from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.